You think Garza tampered with our phone records?
It makes sense, Suresh said. Garza's job, after all, is to protect the palace. And now, if there's any investigation, as far as the palace is concerned, that call never happened. Technically speaking, we have plausible deniability. Deleting the record goes a long way to taking the palace off the hook.
Off the hook? Martine demanded. There's no doubt that that call was made. Ambra put Avila on the guest list, and the Guggenheim front desk will verify.
True, but now it's the word of a young front desk person at a museum against the entire royal palace. As far as our records are concerned, that call simply didn't occur.
Suresh's cut-and-dried assessment seemed overly optimistic to Martine.
And you told Valdespino all of this?
It's just the truth. I told him that whether or not Garza actually placed the call, Garza appears to have deleted it in an effort to protect the palace.
Suresh paused.
But after I hung up with the bishop, I realized something else.
That being?
Technically, there's a third person with access to the server.
Suresh glanced nervously around the room and moved closer.
Prince Julian's login codes give him full access to all systems.
Martine stared.
That's ridiculous.
I know it sounds crazy, he said, but the prince was in the palace, alone in his apartment, at the time that call was made. He could easily have placed it and then logged onto the server and deleted it. The software is simple to use, and the prince is a lot more tech-savvy than people think.
Suresh, Martine snapped, do you really think Prince Julian, the future king of Spain, personally sent an assassin into the Guggenheim Museum to kill Edmund Kirsch?
I don't know, he said. All I'm saying is that it's possible.
Why would Prince Julian do such a thing?
You, of all people, shouldn't have to ask. Remember all the bad press you had to deal with about Ambra and Edmund Kirsch spending time together? The story about how he flew her to his apartment in Barcelona?
They were working. It was business.
Politics is all appearances, Suresh said. You taught me that. And you and I know the prince's marriage proposal has not worked out for him publicly the way he imagined.
Suresh's phone pinged, and he read the incoming message, his face clouding with disbelief.
What is it?
Martine demanded. Without a word, Suresh turned and ran back toward the security center.
Suresh!
Martine stubbed out her cigarette and ran after him, joining him at one of his team's security workstations, where his tech was playing a grainy surveillance tape.
What are we looking at?
Martine demanded.
Rear exit of the cathedral, the techie said, 5 minutes ago.
Martine and Suresh leaned in and watched the video feed as a young acolyte exited the rear of the cathedral, hurried along the relatively quiet Calle Mayor, unlocked an old beat-up opal sedan, and climbed in.
Okay, Martine thought. He's going home after Mass. So what?
On screen, the opal pulled out, drove a short distance, and then pulled up unusually close to the cathedral's rear gate, the same gate through which the acolyte had just exited. Almost instantly, two dark figures slipped out through the gate, crouching low, and jumped into the back seat of the acolyte's car. The two passengers were, without a doubt, Bishop Valdespino and Prince Julian. Moments later, the opal sped off, disappearing around the corner and out of frame.
Chapter 51. Standing like a rough-hewn mountain on the corner of Carrer de Provenza and Passage de Gracia, the 1906 Gaudí masterpiece known as Casa Milà is half apartment building and half timeless work of art. Conceived by Gaudí as a perpetual curve,
The 9-story structure is immediately recognizable by its billowing limestone facade. Its swerving balconies and uneven geometry give the building an organic aura, as if millennia of buffeting winds had carved out hollows and bends like those in a desert canyon. Although Gaudí's shocking modernist design was shunned at first by the neighborhood, Casa Milà was universally lauded by art critics and quickly became one of Barcelona's brightest architectural jewels. For 3 decades, Pere Milà, the businessman who commissioned the building, had resided with his wife in the sprawling main apartment while renting out the building's 20 remaining flats. To this day, Casa Milà at Passage de Gracia 92 is considered one of the most exclusive and coveted addresses in all of Spain. As Robert Langdon navigated Kirsch's Tesla through sparse traffic on the elegant tree-lined avenue, he sensed they were getting close. Passage de Gracia was Barcelona's version of the Champs-Élysées in Paris. The widest and grandest of avenues, impeccably landscaped and lined with designer boutiques. Chanel, Gucci, Cartier, Longchamp. Finally, Langdon saw it, 200 meters away. Softly lit from below, Casa Milà's pale, pitted limestone and oblong balconies set it instantly apart from its rectilinear neighbors, as if a beautiful piece of ocean coral had washed into shore and come to rest on a beach made of cinder blocks.
"I was afraid of this," Ambra said, pointing urgently down the elegant avenue. "Look."
Langdon lowered his gaze to the wide sidewalk in front of Casa Milà. It looked like there were a half dozen media trucks parked in front, and a host of reporters were giving live updates using Kirsch's residence as a backdrop. Several security agents were positioned to keep the crowds away from the entrance. Edmund's death, it seemed, had transformed anything Kirsch-related into a news story. Langdon scanned Passage de Gracia for a place to pull over, but he saw nothing, and traffic was moving steadily. "Get down," he urged Ambra, realizing he had no choice now but to drive directly past the corner where all the press were assembled. Ambra slid down in her seat, crouching on the floor, entirely out of view. Langdon turned his head away as they drove past the crowded corner. "It looks like they're surrounding the main entrance," he said. "We'll never get in." "Take a right," Winston interjected with a note of cheerful confidence. "I imagined this might happen." Blogger Hector Marcano gazed up mournfully at the top floor of Casa Milà, still trying to accept that Edmund Kirsch was truly gone. For 3 years, Hector had been reporting on technology for Barcino.com, a popular collaborative platform for Barcelona's entrepreneurs and cutting-edge startups. Having the great Edmund Kirsch living here in Barcelona had felt almost like working at the feet of Zeus himself. Hector had first met Kirsch more than a year ago when the legendary futurist graciously agreed to speak at Barcino's flagship monthly event, Fuck Up Night, a seminar in which a wildly successful entrepreneur spoke openly about his or her biggest failures. Kirsch sheepishly admitted to the crowd that he had spent more than $400 million over 6 months chasing his dream of building what he called E-Wave, a quantum computer with processing speeds so fast they would facilitate unprecedented advances across all the sciences, especially in complex systems modeling. "I'm afraid," Edmund had admitted, "so far, my quantum leap in quantum computing is a quantum dud." Tonight, when Hector heard that Kirsch planned to announce an earth-shattering discovery, he was thrilled at the thought that it might be related to E-Wave. Did he discover the key to making it work? But after Kirsch's philosophical preamble, Hector realized his discovery was something else entirely. I wonder if we'll ever know what he found, Hector thought. His heart so heavy that he had come to Kirsch's home not to blog, but to pay reverent homage. E-Wave! Someone shouted nearby. E-Wave! All around Hector, the assembled crowd began pointing and aiming their cameras at a sleek black Tesla that was now easing slowly onto the plaza and inching toward the crowd with its halogen headlights glaring. Hector stared at the familiar vehicle in astonishment. Kirsch's Tesla Model X, with its E-Wave license plate, was as famous in Barcelona as the Pope Mobile was in Rome. Kirsch would often make a show of double parking on Carrer de Provenza, outside the Daniel Vior jewelry shop, getting out to sign autographs and then thrilling the crowd by letting his car's self-park feature drive the empty vehicle on a pre-programmed route up the street and across the wide sidewalk, its sensors detecting any pedestrians or obstacles, until it reached the garage gate, which it would then open and slowly wind down the spiral ramp into the private garage beneath Casa Milà. While self-park was a standard feature on all Teslas, easily opening garage doors, driving straight in, and turning themselves off, Edmund had proudly hacked his Tesla's system to enable the more complex route. All part of the show. Tonight, the spectacle was considerably stranger. Kirsch was deceased, and yet his car had just appeared, moving slowly up Carrer de Provenza, continuing across the sidewalk, aligning itself with the elegant garage door, and inching forward as people cleared the way. Reporters and cameramen rushed to the vehicle, squinting through the heavily tinted windows and shouting in surprise, "It's empty! Nobody is driving! Where did it come from?" The Casa Milà security guards had apparently witnessed this trick before, and they held people back from the Tesla and away from the garage door as it opened. For Hector, the sight of Edmund's empty car creeping toward its garage conjured images of a bereft dog returning home after losing its master. Like a ghost, the Tesla made its way silently through the garage door, and the crowd broke into emotional applause to see Edmund's beloved car, as it had done so many times before, begin its descent down the spiral ramp into Barcelona's very first subterranean parking facility.
"I didn't know you were so claustrophobic," Umbra whispered, lying beside Langdon on the floor of the Tesla.
They were crammed into the small area between the second and third row of seats, hidden beneath a black vinyl car cover that Umbra had taken from the cargo area, invisible through the tinted windows.
"I'll survive," Langdon managed shakily, more nervous about the self-driving car than his phobia.
He could feel the vehicle winding down a steep spiral ramp and feared it would crash at any moment. 2 minutes earlier, while they were double-parked on Carrer de Provenza, outside the Daniel Vior jewelry shop, Winston had given them crystal-clear directions. Umbra and Langdon, without exiting the car, had climbed back to the Model X's third row of seats, and then, with the press of a single button on the phone, Umbra had activated the car's customized self-park feature. In the darkness, Langdon had felt the car driving itself slowly down the street, and with Umbra's body pressed against his in the tight space, he could not help but recall his first teenage experience in the back seat of a car with a pretty girl. "I was more nervous back then," he thought. Which seemed ironic, considering he was now lying in a driverless car, spooning the future Queen of Spain. Langdon felt the car straighten out at the bottom of the ramp, make a few slow turns, and then slide to a full stop. "You have arrived," Winston said. Immediately, Umbra pulled back the tarp and carefully sat up, peering out the window.
"Clear," she said, clambering out.
Langdon got out after her, relieved to be standing in the open air of the garage.
"Elevators are in the main foyer,"
Umbra said, motioning up the winding driveway ramp. Langdon's gaze, however, was suddenly transfixed by a wholly unexpected sight. Here, in this underground parking garage, on the cement wall directly in front of Edmund's parking space, hung an elegantly framed painting of a seaside landscape. "Umbra," Langdon said, "Edmund decorated his parking spot with a painting?" She nodded.
"I asked him the same question. He told me it was his way of being welcomed home every night by a radiant beauty."
Langdon chuckled. "Bachelors." "The artist is someone Edmund revered greatly," Winston said, his voice now transferring automatically to Kirsch's cell phone in Umbra's hand. "Do you recognize him?" Langdon did not. The painting seemed to be nothing more than an accomplished watercolor seascape, nothing like Edmund's usual avant-garde taste.
"It's Churchill," Umbra said. "Edmund quoted him all the time."
Churchill. Langdon needed a moment to realize she was referring to none other than Winston Churchill himself, the celebrated British statesman who, in addition to being a military hero, historian, orator, and Nobel Prize-winning author, was an artist of remarkable talent. Langdon now recalled Edmund quoting the British Prime Minister once in response to a comment someone made about religious people hating him. "You have enemies? Good. That means you've stood up for something." It was the diversity of Churchill's talents that most impressed Edmund, Winston said. "Humans rarely display proficiency across such a broad spectrum of activities."
"And that's why Edmund named you Winston."
"It is," the computer replied. "High praise from Edmund."
"Glad I asked," Langdon thought. Having imagined Winston's name was an allusion to Watson, the IBM computer that had dominated the Jeopardy television game show a decade ago. No doubt Watson was probably now considered a primitive, single-celled bacterium on the evolutionary scale of synthetic intelligence.
"Okay, then," Langdon said, motioning to the elevators. "Let's head upstairs and try to find what we came for."
At that precise moment, inside Madrid's Almudena Cathedral, Commander Diego Garza was clutching his phone and listening in disbelief as the palace's PR coordinator, Monica Martin, gave him an update. "Valdespino and Prince Julian left the safety of the compound?" Garza could not begin to imagine what they were thinking. "They're driving around Madrid in an acolyte's car? That's madness."
"We can contact the transportation authorities," Martin said. "Suresh believes they can use traffic cams to help track—"
"No," Garza declared.
"Alerting anyone to the fact that the prince is outside the palace without security is far too dangerous. His safety is our primary concern."
"Understood, sir," Martin said, sounding suddenly uneasy. "There's something else you should know. It's about a missing phone record."
"Hold on," Garza said, distracted by the arrival of his four Guardia agents, who, to his mystification, strode over and encircled him. Before Garza could react, his agents had skillfully relieved him of his sidearm and phone.
"Commander Garza," his lead agent said, stone-faced, "I have direct orders to place you under arrest."
Chapter 52. Casa Milà is built in the shape of an infinity sign, an endless curve that doubles back over itself and forms two undulating chasms that penetrate the building. Each of these open-air light wells is nearly 100 feet deep, crumpled like a partially collapsed tube, and from the air they resemble two massive sinkholes in the roof of the building. From where Langdon stood at the base of the narrower light well, the effect looking skyward was decidedly unsettling, like being lodged in the throat of a giant beast. Beneath Langdon's feet, the stone floor was sloped and uneven. A helix staircase spiraled up the interior of the shaft, its railing forged of wrought iron latticework that mimicked the uneven chambers of a sea sponge. A small jungle of twisting vines and swooping palms spilled over the banisters, as if about to overgrow the entire space. Living architecture, Langdon mused, marveling at Gaudí's ability to imbue his work with an almost biological quality. Langdon's eyes climbed higher again, up the sides of the gorge, scaling the curved walls, where a quilt of brown and green tiles intermingled with muted frescoes depicting plants and flowers that seemed to be growing up toward the oblong patch of night sky at the top of the open shaft.
"Elevators are this way,"
Umbra whispered, leading him around the edge of the courtyard.
"Edmund's apartment is all the way up."
As they boarded the uncomfortably small elevator, Langdon pictured the building's top-floor garret, which he had visited once, to see the small Gaudí exhibit housed there. As he recalled, the Casa Milà attic was a dark, sinuous series of rooms with very few windows. "Edmund could live anywhere," Langdon said as the elevator began to climb. "I still can't believe he leased an attic."
"It's a strange apartment,"
Umbra agreed.
"But as you know, Edmund was eccentric."
When the elevator reached the top floor, they disembarked into an elegant hallway and climbed an additional set of winding stairs to a private landing at the very top of the building.
"This is it,"
Umbra said, motioning to a sleek metal door that had no knob or keyhole. The futuristic portal looked entirely out of place in this building, and clearly had been added by Edmund. "You said you know where he hides his key?" Langdon asked. Umbra held up Edmund's phone.
"The same place where he seems to hide everything."
She pressed the phone against the metal door, which beeped 3 times, and Langdon heard a series of deadbolts sliding open. Umbra pocketed the phone and pushed the door open.
"After you,"
she said with a flourish. Langdon stepped over the threshold into a dimly lit foyer, whose walls and ceiling were pale brick. The floor was stone, and the air tasted thin. As he moved through the entryway into the open space beyond, he found himself face to face with a massive painting, which hung on the rear wall, impeccably illuminated by museum-quality pin lights. When Langdon saw the work, he stopped dead in his tracks.
"My God, is that the original?"
Umbra smiled.
"Yes, I was going to mention it on the plane, but I thought I'd surprise you."
Speechless, Langdon moved toward the masterpiece. It was about 12 feet long and more than 4 feet tall, far larger than he recalled from seeing it previously in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts.
"I heard this was sold to an anonymous collector, but I had no idea it was Edmund."
"When I first saw it in the apartment," Umbra said, "I could not believe that Edmund had a taste for this style of art. But now that I know what he was working on this year, the painting seems eerily appropriate."
Langdon nodded, incredulous. This celebrated masterpiece was one of the signature works by French post-impressionist Paul Gauguin, a groundbreaking painter who epitomized the symbolist movement of the late 1800s and helped pave the way for modern art. As Langdon moved toward the painting, he was immediately struck by how similar Gauguin's palette was to that of the Casa Milà entryway, a blend of organic greens, browns, and blues, also depicting a very naturalistic scene. Despite the intriguing collection of people and animals that appeared in Gauguin's painting, Langdon's gaze moved immediately to the upper left-hand corner, to a bright yellow patch on which was inscribed the title of this work. Langdon read the words in disbelief. "D'où venons-nous? Que sommes-nous? Où allons-nous? Where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? Langdon wondered if being confronted by these questions every day as he returned to his home had somehow helped inspire Edmund. Ambra joined Langdon in front of the painting.
Edmund said he wanted to be motivated by these questions whenever he entered his home.
Hard to miss, Langdon thought. Seeing how prominently Edmund had displayed the masterpiece, Langdon wondered if perhaps the painting itself might hold some clue as to what Edmund had discovered. At first glance, the painting's subject seemed far too primitive to hint at an advanced scientific discovery. Its broad, uneven brushstrokes depicted a Tahitian jungle inhabited by an assortment of native Tahitians and animals. Langdon knew the painting well, and as he recalled, Gauguin intended this work to be read from right to left, in the reverse direction from that of standard French text, and so Langdon's eye quickly traced the familiar figures in reverse direction. On the far right, a newborn baby slept on a boulder, representing life's beginning. Where do we come from? In the middle, an assortment of people of different ages carried out the daily activities of life. What are we? And on the left, a decrepit old woman sat alone, deep in thought, seeming to ponder her own mortality. Where are we going? Langdon was surprised that he hadn't thought of this painting immediately when Edmund first described the focus of his discovery. What is our origin? What is our destiny? Langdon eyed the other elements of the painting. Dogs, cats, and birds, which seemed to be doing nothing in particular, a primitive goddess statue in the background, a mountain, twisting roots, and trees, and of course, Gauguin's famous strange white bird, which sat beside the elderly woman and, according to the artist, represented the futility of words.
Futile or not, Langdon thought, words are what we came here for. Preferably 47 characters worth.
For an instant, he wondered if the painting's unusual title might relate directly to the 47-letter password they were seeking. But a quick count in both French and English did not add up.
Okay, we're looking for a line of poetry, Langdon said hopefully. Edmund's library is this way, Ambra told him.
She pointed to her left, down a wide corridor, which Langdon could see was appointed with elegant home furnishings that were interspersed with assorted Gaudí artifacts and displays.
Edmund lives in a museum?
Langdon still couldn't quite wrap his mind around it. The Casa Milà loft was not exactly the homiest place he had ever seen. Constructed entirely of stone and brick, it was essentially a continuous ribbed tunnel, a loop of 270 parabolic arches of varying heights, each about a yard apart. There were very few windows, and the atmosphere tasted dry and sterile, clearly heavily processed to protect the Gaudí artifacts.
I'll join you in a moment, Langdon said. First, I'm going to find Edmund's restroom.
Ambra glanced awkwardly back toward the entrance.
Edmund always asked me to use the lobby downstairs. He was mysteriously protective of this apartment's private bathroom.
It's a bachelor pad. His bathroom is probably a mess, and he was embarrassed.
Ambra smiled.
Well, I think it's that way.
She pointed in the opposite direction from the library, down a very dark tunnel.
Thanks. I'll be right back.
Ambra headed off toward Edmund's office, and Langdon went in the opposite direction, making his way down the narrow corridor, a dramatic tunnel of brick archways that reminded him of an underground grotto or medieval catacomb. Eerily, as he moved along the stone tunnel, banks of soft, motion-sensitive lights illuminated at the base of each parabolic arch, lighting his way. Langdon passed an elegant reading area, a small exercise area, and even a pantry, all interspersed with various display tables of Gaudí drawings, architectural sketches, and 3D models of his projects. When he passed an illuminated display table of biological artifacts, however, Langdon stopped short, surprised by the contents. A fossil of a prehistoric fish, an elegant nautilus shell, and a sinuous skeleton of a snake. For a passing moment, Langdon imagined Edmund must have mounted this scientific display himself, perhaps relating to his studies of the origins of life. Then Langdon saw the annotation on the case and realized that these artifacts had belonged to Gaudí and echoed various architectural features of this home. The fish scales were the tiled patterns on the walls. The nautilus was the curling ramp into the garage, and the snake skeleton with its hundreds of closely spaced ribs was this very hallway. Accompanying the display were the architect's humble words, "Nothing is invented, for it's written in nature first. Originality consists of returning to the origin." Antoni Gaudí. Langdon turned his eyes down the winding, vault-ribbed corridor and once again felt like he was standing inside a living creature. A perfect home for Edmund, he decided. Art inspired by science. As Langdon followed the first bend in the serpentine tunnel, the space widened and the motion-activated lights illuminated. His gaze was drawn immediately to a huge glass display case in the center of the hall. A catenary model, he thought, having always marveled at these ingenious Gaudí prototypes. Catenary was an architectural term that referred to the curve that was formed by a cord hanging loosely between two fixed points, like a hammock or the velvet rope suspended between two stanchions in a theater. In the catenary model before Langdon, dozens of chains had been suspended loosely from the top of the case, resulting in long lengths that swooped down and then back up to form limply hanging U-shapes. Because gravitational tension was the inverse of gravitational compression, Gaudí could study the precise shape assumed by a chain when naturally hanging under its own weight, and he could mimic that shape to solve the architectural challenges of gravitational compression. "But it requires a magic mirror," Langdon mused, moving toward the case. As anticipated, the floor of the case was a mirror, and as he peered down into the reflection, he saw a magical effect. The entire model flipped upside down, and the hanging loops became soaring spires. In this case, Langdon realized, he was seeing an inverted aerial view of Gaudí's towering Basilica de la Sagrada Familia, whose gently sloping spires quite possibly had been designed using this very model. Pressing on down the hall, Langdon found himself in an elegant sleeping space with an antique four-poster bed, a cherrywood armoire, and an inlaid chest of drawers. The walls were decorated with Gaudí design sketches, which Langdon realized were simply more of the museum's exhibit. The only piece of art in the room that seemed to have been added was a large calligraphied quote hanging over Edmund's bed. Langdon read the first three words and immediately recognized the source. "God is dead. God remains dead. And we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers?" Nietzsche. "God is dead" were the three most famous words written by Friedrich Nietzsche, the renowned 19th-century German philosopher and atheist. Nietzsche was notorious for his scathing critiques of religion, but also for his reflections on science, especially Darwinian evolution, which he believed had transported humankind to the brink of nihilism, an awareness that life had no meaning, no higher purpose, and offered no direct evidence of the existence of God. Seeing the quote over the bed, Langdon wondered if perhaps Edmund, for all his anti-religious bluster, might have been struggling with his own role in attempting to rid the world of God. The Nietzsche quote, as Langdon recalled, concluded with the words, Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we ourselves not become gods simply to appear worthy of it? This bold idea that man must become God in order to kill God was at the core of Nietzsche's thinking, and perhaps, Langdon realized, partially explained the God complexes suffered by so many pioneering technology geniuses like Edmund. Those who erase God must be gods. As Langdon pondered the notion, he was struck by a second realization. Nietzsche was not just a philosopher. He was also a poet. Langdon himself owned Nietzsche's The Peacock and the Buffalo, a compilation of 275 poems and aphorisms that offered thoughts on God, death, and the human mind. Langdon quickly counted the characters in the framed quote. They were not a match, and yet a surge of hope swelled within him. Could Nietzsche be the poet of the line we're seeking? If so, will we find a book of Nietzsche's poetry in Edmund's office? Either way, Langdon would ask Winston to access an online compilation of Nietzsche's poems and search them all for a line containing 47 characters. Eager to get back to Ambra and share his thoughts, Langdon hurried through the bedroom into the restroom that was visible beyond. As he entered, the lights inside came on to reveal an elegantly decorated bathroom containing a pedestal sink, a freestanding shower unit, and a toilet. Langdon's eyes were drawn immediately to a low antique table, cluttered with toiletries and personal items. When he saw the items on the table, he inhaled sharply, taking a step back. Oh, God. Edmund. No. The table before him looked like a back-alley drug lab, used syringes, pill bottles, loose capsules, and even a rag spotted with blood. Langdon's heart sank. Edmund was taking drugs? Langdon knew that chemical addiction had become painfully commonplace these days, even among the rich and famous. Heroin was cheaper than beer now, and people were popping opioid painkillers like they were ibuprofen. Addiction would certainly explain his recent weight loss, Langdon thought, wondering if maybe Edmund had been pretending to have gone vegan, only in an attempt to cover for his thinness and sunken eyes. Langdon walked to the table and picked up one of the bottles, reading the prescription label, fully expecting to find one of the common opioids like OxyContin or Percocet. Instead, he saw docetaxel. Puzzled, he checked another bottle. Gemcitabine. What are these? He wondered, checking a third bottle. Fluorouracil. Langdon froze. He had heard of fluorouracil through a colleague at Harvard, and he felt a sudden wave of dread. An instant later, he spied a pamphlet lying among the bottles. The title was, Does Veganism Slow Pancreatic Cancer? Langdon's jaw dropped as the truth hit him. Edmund wasn't a drug addict. He was secretly fighting a deadly cancer. Chapter 53. Ambra Vidal stood in the soft light of the attic apartment and ran her eyes across the rows of books lining the walls of Edmund's library. His collection is larger than I remembered. Edmund had transformed a wide section of curved hallway into a stunning library by building shelves between the vertical supports of Gaudí's vaults. His library was unexpectedly large and well-stocked, especially considering Edmund had allegedly planned to be here for only 2 years. It looks like he moved in for good. Eyeing the crowded shelves, Ambra realized that locating Edmund's favorite line of poetry would be far more time-consuming than anticipated. As she continued walking along the shelves, scanning the spines of the books, she saw nothing but scientific tomes on cosmology, consciousness, and artificial intelligence. The big picture, forces of nature, origins of consciousness, the biology of belief, intelligent algorithms, our final invention. She reached the end of one section and stepped around an architectural rib into the next section of shelves. Here she found a wide array of scientific topics: thermodynamics, primordial chemistry, psychology. No poetry. Noting that Winston had been quiet for some time now, Ambra pulled out Kirsch's cell phone.
"Winston, are we still connected?"
"I'm here," his accented voice chimed.
"Did Edmund actually read all of these books in his library?"
"I believe so, yes," Winston replied. "He was a voracious consumer of text and called this library his trophy room of knowledge."
"And is there, by any chance, a poetry section in here?"
"The only titles of which I'm specifically aware are the non-fiction volumes that I was asked to read in e-book format, so Edmund and I could discuss their contents, an exercise, I suspect, that was more for my education than for his. Unfortunately, I do not have this entire collection catalogued, so the only way you will be able to find what you're looking for will be by an actual physical search."
"I understand."
"While you search, there is one thing, I think, that may interest you. Breaking news from Madrid regarding your fiancé, Prince Julian."
"What's happening?"
Ambra demanded, halting abruptly. Her emotions still churned over Julian's possible involvement in Kirsch's assassination.
"There's no proof," she reminded herself.
"Nothing confirms that Julian helped put Avila's name on the guest list." "It was just reported," Winston said, "that a raucous demonstration is forming outside the royal palace. Evidence continues to suggest that Edmund's assassination was secretly arranged by Bishop Valdespino, probably with the help of someone inside the palace, perhaps even the prince. Fans of Kirsch are now picketing. Have a look." Edmund's smartphone began streaming footage of angry protesters at the palace gates. One carried a sign in English that read, "Pontius Pilate killed your prophet, you killed ours." Others were carrying spray-painted bedsheets emblazoned with a single-word battle cry, "Apostasia," accompanied by a logo that was now being stenciled with increasing frequency on the sidewalks of Madrid. A silhouette of a person, arm extended, dropping an item into a large wastebasket. The item was a crucifix. Apostasy had become a popular rallying cry for Spain's liberal youth. Renounce the church.
"Has Julian made a statement yet?"
Ambra asked. "That's one of the problems," Winston replied. "Not a word from Julian, nor the bishop, nor anyone at all in the palace. The continued silence has made everyone suspicious. Conspiracy theories are rampant, and the national press has now begun questioning where you are and why you have not commented publicly on this crisis either."
"Me?"
Ambra was horrified at the thought. "You witnessed the murder. You are the future queen consort and the love of Prince Julian's life. The public wants to hear you say that you are certain Julian is not involved." Ambra's gut told her that Julian could not possibly have known about Edmund's murder. When she thought back to their courtship, she recalled a tender and sincere man, admittedly naive and impulsively romantic, but certainly no murderer. "Similar questions are surfacing now about Professor Langdon," Winston said. "Media outlets have begun asking why the professor has disappeared without comment, especially after featuring so prominently in Edmund's presentation. Several conspiracy blogs are suggesting that his disappearance may actually be related to his involvement in Kirsch's murder."
"But that's crazy."
"The topic is gaining traction. The theory stems from Langdon's past search for the Holy Grail and the bloodline of Christ. Apparently, the Salic descendants of Christ have historical ties to the Carlist movement, and the assassin's tattoo..."
"Stop,"
Ambra interrupted. "This is absurd." And yet others are speculating that Langdon has disappeared because he himself has become a target tonight. Everyone has become an armchair detective. Much of the world is collaborating at this moment to figure out what mysteries Edmund uncovered and who wanted to silence him.
Umbra's attention was drawn by the sound of Langdon's footsteps approaching briskly up the winding corridor. She turned just as he appeared around the corner.
"Umbra," he called, his voice taut. "Were you aware that Edmund was seriously ill?"
"Ill?"
she said, startled.
"No."
Langdon told her what he had found in Edmund's private bathroom. Umbra was thunderstruck.
"Pancreatic cancer? That's the reason Edmund was so pale and thin?" Incredibly, Edmund had never said a word about being ill. Umbra now understood his maniacal work ethic over the past few months.
Edmund knew he was running out of time.
"Winston," she demanded, "did you know about Edmund's illness?"
"Yes," Winston replied without hesitation. "It was something he kept very private. He learned of his disease 22 months ago, and immediately changed his diet and began working with increased intensity. He also relocated to this attic space, where he would breathe museum-quality air and be protected from UV radiation. He needed to live in darkness as much as possible because his medications made him photosensitive. Edmund managed to outlive his doctor's projections by a considerable margin. Recently, though, he had started to fail. Based on empirical evidence I gathered from worldwide databases on pancreatic cancer, I analyzed Edmund's deterioration and calculated that he had 9 days to live."
9 days, Umbra thought, overcome with guilt for teasing Edmund about his vegan diet and about working too hard. The man was sick. He was racing tirelessly to create his final moment of glory before his time ran out. This sad realization only further fueled Umbra's determination to locate this poem and complete what Edmund had started.
"I haven't found any poetry books yet," she said to Langdon. "So far, it's all science."
"I think the poet we're looking for might be Friedrich Nietzsche," Langdon said, telling her about the framed quote over Edmund's bed.
"That particular quote doesn't have 47 letters, but it certainly implies Edmund was a fan of Nietzsche."
"Winston," Umbra said, "can you search Nietzsche's collected works of poetry and isolate any lines that have exactly 47 letters?
"Certainly," Winston replied. "German originals or English translations?"
Umbra paused, uncertain.
"Start with English," Langdon prompted. Edmund planned to input the line of poetry on his phone, and his keypad would have no easy way to input any of German's umlauted letters or ersatz.
Umbra nodded. "Smart."
"I have your results," Winston announced almost immediately. "I have found nearly 300 translated poems, resulting in 192 lines of precisely 47 letters.
Langdon sighed. "That many?"
"Winston," Umbra pressed, "Edmund described his favorite line as a prophecy, a prediction about the future, one that was already coming true. Do you see anything that fits that description?"
"I'm sorry," Winston replied. "I see nothing here that suggests a prophecy. Linguistically speaking, the lines in question are all extracted from longer stanzas and appear to be partial thoughts. Shall I display them for you?"
"There are too many," Langdon said. "We need to find a physical book and hope that Edmund marked his favorite line in some way."
"Then I suggest you hurry," Winston said. "It appears your presence here may no longer be a secret."
"Why do you say that?" Langdon demanded.
"Local news is reporting that a military plane has just landed at Barcelona's El Prat airport, and that 2 Guardia Real agents have deplaned." On the outskirts of Madrid, Bishop Valdespino was feeling grateful to have escaped the palace before the walls had closed in on him. wedged beside Prince Julian in the back seat of his acolyte's tiny opal sedan, Valdespino hoped that desperate measures now being enacted behind the scenes would help him regain control of a knight careening wildly off course.
La casita del principe, Valdespino had ordered the acolyte as the young man drove them away from the palace.
The cottage of the prince was situated in a secluded rural area 40 minutes outside Madrid. More mansion than cottage, the casita had served as the private residence for the heir to the Spanish throne since the middle of the 1700s, a secluded spot where boys could be boys, before settling into the serious business of running a country. Valdespino had assured Julian that retiring to his cottage would be far safer than remaining in the palace tonight.
Except I am not taking Julian to the cottage, the bishop knew, glancing over at the prince, who was gazing out the car window, apparently deep in thought.
Valdespino wondered if the prince was truly as naive as he appeared, or if, like his father, Julian had mastered the skill of showing the world only that side of himself that he wanted to be seen. Chapter 54. The handcuffs on Garza's wrists felt unnecessarily tight. These guys are serious, he thought, still utterly bewildered by the actions of his own Guardia agents.
What the hell is going on?
Garza demanded again as his men marched him out of the cathedral and into the night air of the plaza. Still no reply. As the entourage moved across the wide expanse toward the palace, Garza realized there was an array of TV cameras and protesters outside the front gate.
At least take me around back, he said to his lead man. Don't make this a public spectacle.
The soldiers ignored his plea and pressed on, forcing Garza to march directly across the plaza. Within seconds, voices outside the gate started shouting, and the blazing glare of spotlights swung toward him. Blinded and fuming, Garza forced himself to assume a calm expression and hold his head high as the Guardia marched him within a few yards of the gate, directly past the yelling cameramen and reporters. A cacophony of voices began hurling questions at Garza.
Why are you being arrested? What did you do, Commander? Were you involved in the assassination of Edmund Kirsch?
Garza fully expected his agents to continue past the crowd without even a glance, but to his shock, the agents stopped abruptly, holding him still in front of the cameras. From the direction of the palace, a familiar pant-suited figure was striding briskly across the plaza toward them. It was Monica Martin. Garza had no doubt that she would be stunned to see his predicament. Strangely, though, when Martin arrived, she eyed him not with surprise, but with contempt. The guards forcibly turned Garza to face the reporters. Monica Martin held up her hand to quiet the crowd and then drew a small sheet of paper from her pocket. Adjusting her thick glasses, she read a statement directly into the television cameras.
The Royal Palace, she announced, is hereby arresting Commander Diego Garza for his role in the murder of Edmund Kirsch, as well as his attempts to implicate Bishop Valdespino in that crime.
Before Garza could even process the preposterous accusation, the guards were muscling him off toward the palace. As he departed, he could hear Monica Martin continuing her statement.
Regarding our future queen, Ambra Vidal, she declared, and the American professor Robert Langdon, I'm afraid I have some deeply disturbing news.
Downstairs in the palace, Director of Electronic Security, Suresh Bala, stood in front of the television, riveted by the live broadcast of Monica Martin's impromptu press conference in the plaza. She does not look happy. Only 5 minutes ago, Martin had received a personal phone call which she had taken in her office, speaking in hushed tones and taking careful notes. 60 seconds later, she had emerged, looking as shaken as Suresh had ever seen her. With no explanation, Martine carried her notes directly out to the plaza and addressed the media. Whether or not her claims were accurate, one thing was certain. The person who had ordered this statement had just placed Robert Langdon in very serious danger. Who gave those orders to Monica? Suresh wondered. As he tried to make sense of the PR coordinator's bizarre behavior, his computer pinged with an incoming message. Suresh went over and eyed the screen, stunned to see who had written him. Monte@iglesia.org. The informant, thought Suresh. It was the same person who had been feeding information to Conspiracy Net all night, and now, for some reason, that person was contacting Suresh directly. Warily, Suresh sat down and opened the email. It read, "I hacked Valdespino's texts. He has dangerous secrets. The palace should access his SMS records. Now." Alarmed, Suresh read the message again. Then he deleted it. For a long moment he sat in silence, pondering his options. Then, coming to a decision, he quickly generated a master key card to the royal apartments and slipped upstairs, unseen. Chapter 55. With increasing urgency, Langdon ran his eyes along the collection of books lining Edmund's hallway. Poetry. There's got to be some poetry here somewhere. The Guardia's unexpected arrival in Barcelona had started a dangerous, ticking clock, and yet Langdon felt confident that time would not run out. After all, once he and Ambra had located Edmund's favorite line of poetry, they would need only seconds to enter it into Edmund's phone and play the presentation for the world, as Edmund intended. Langdon glanced over at Ambra, who was on the opposite side of the hall, farther down, continuing her search of the left-hand side, as Langdon combed the right. "Do you see anything over there?" Ambra shook her head. "So far, only science and philosophy. No poetry, no Nietzsche." "Keep looking," Langdon told her, returning to his search. Currently, he was scanning a section of thick tomes on history. Privilege, persecution, and prophecy, the Catholic Church in Spain. By the Sword and the Cross, the historical evolution of the Catholic world monarchy. The titles reminded him of a dark tale Edmund had shared years ago, after Langdon had commented that Edmund, for an American atheist, seemed to have an unusual obsession with Spain and Catholicism. "My mother was a native Spaniard," Edmund had replied flatly, "and a guilt-ridden Catholic." As Edmund shared the tragic tale of his childhood and his mother, Langdon could only listen with great surprise. Edmund's mother, Paloma Calvo, the computer scientist explained, had been the daughter of simple laborers in Cadiz, Spain. At 19, she fell in love with a university teacher from Chicago, Michael Kirsch, who was on sabbatical in Spain, and had become pregnant. Having witnessed the shunning of other unwed mothers in her strict Catholic community, Paloma saw no option but to accept the man's half-hearted offer to marry her and move to Chicago. Shortly after her son, Edmund, was born, Paloma's husband was struck by a car and killed while biking home from class. Castigo divino, her own father called it, divine punishment. Paloma's parents refused to let their daughter return home to Cadiz and bring shame to their household. Instead, they warned that Paloma's dire circumstances were a clear sign of God's anger, and that the kingdom of heaven would never accept her unless she dedicated herself body and soul to Christ for the rest of her life. After giving birth to Edmund, Paloma worked as a maid in a motel and tried to raise him as best as she could. At night, in their meager apartment, she read scripture and prayed for forgiveness. But her destitution only deepened, and with it, her certainty that God was not yet satisfied with her penance. Disgraced and fearful, Paloma became convinced after 5 years that the most profound act of maternal love she could show her child would be to give him a new life, one shielded from God's punishment of Paloma's sins.